Welcome back to the Fascinating Jobs Podcast. I'm your host, Mackenzie Wilson. On this episode of the podcast, I'm sitting down with Dr. Kimberly Scherer, a parenting and teen expert who is the founder and CEO of the Academy for Independence, host of the podcast Raising Unstoppable Teens, and author of the book Unstoppable Teens. As always, please leave a review wherever you listen if you like this podcast. It helps us to get recognized. With that, let's get into episode number 3 with Dr. Scherer. All right. So, hi, Dr. Scherer. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. How are you doing?
I am doing well, and thank you for having me.
No problem. So, I guess we can just get right into it. So, how did you decide that you wanted to study psychology in particular?
I decided that actually being in high school. And I think one of the reasons, well, a couple. One, I've always had a passion for self-growth and learning. And two, in high school, a lot of friends came to me, I guess, with advice and kind of appreciated the fact that I really listened to them. And I think that just reinforced my passion to go into the field of psychology.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I think that a lot of our listeners could be people in high school. So were there any like particular activities that you did in high school, you know, other than you mentioned your friends like coming to you for advice? Were there any other activities that you kind of used to explore psychology in high school? Or was that something that you maybe discovered later on?
Well, I did take, you know, high school psychology class and found that fascinating. And then also did community service, and it wasn't so much in the field of counseling, but just the idea of getting out there and contributing, you know, to helping younger kids at the time. And I think that all helped. But truly, it was my natural inclination, if you will, and was always just a tug at my heart. And that's really what made me feel solid in choosing that.
Yeah, I think that's some great advice, and I think that a lot of our listeners are maybe in high school, so like, as you mentioned, volunteering is like a good way that they can kind of maybe try that out and see if it's something that they're interested in, but like you mentioned, like, you have to have a passion for it. So you're obviously a doctor, so what was the PhD process like for getting your PhD in psychology?
I think that process, it's been an evolution. So I think with going into the field of psychology, so I decided on that I wanted a private practice. That's what I wanted. And I decided that in high school. And then when I first entered college, actually my father said, oh, why do you want to go into psychology? Go into business, because he was a businessman. And so I took a few of like those courses and realized that no, that wasn't where my heart lies. And so I continued with psychology and knew that if I wanted to have a private practice, I would have to have graduate school. And I was okay with that. And that to get a PhD is like the, you know, going for the gold. But I will say that I kind of halted the PhD process and had children and became a homeschooling mom and kind of went that route first and got the PhD. I did receive my master's early on, but to actually receive my PhD, that was something I returned to many, many years later as an adult.
Wow, yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that's like a good way to kind of fit the PhD into your life. So how was the process? Was it like incredibly difficult? How time-consuming was it? Could you just give us a bit more detail into what that was like?
The PhD process when I first entered it at a younger age, I mean, straight after getting my bachelor's degree, it's intense. I mean, because you're now in graduate school, you're probably, you know, or at least I was living independently. There's rent and bills that I had to pay in addition to doing an internship for sometimes not any pay, in addition to keeping up with your studies and wanting to do, you know, and excel in those. I will say one of the most difficult things was trying to find the balance between having some space and personal time with everything that's kind of required to receive your degree. And getting it as an adult was much, much easier because a lot of the things have already been established. So I had more time to work on it. So it was easier as an adult than as kind of a young adult.
Yeah, I completely understand that. And I think that's like a good comparison to make between like what it was like maybe getting at a younger age versus at an older age. So you were explaining how maybe one of the challenges was managing your time and finding personal time. So what were some strategies that you kind of used to, you know, give yourself some personal time?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure when I was younger what were some strategies, or even if I applied them, I probably just worked. And that is something I still have to balance. And I think the best way to do that is, one, you need to become aware of that and pay attention to, for example, I'll just give this example. This is a very recent example of writing the book and having that deadline. And I had some other projects in the works with other deadlines. And so all I did was I just worked to meet those deadlines. And that was late last year. And then this year, I have found at the beginning of the year, just not being motivated, not having the energy to work on some other creative projects, which is highly unlike me. And then I recently realized that that dip was because I was so caught up in that kind of force energy of working, that I really just had to step back. And it was when I went on vacation to visit my daughter and then came coming back that that space really gave me perspective. And so now I'm really being more mindful of saying no.
Yeah.
So I don't get overwhelmed, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that this is a discussion that's been reoccurring on episodes of the podcast, is especially when you're starting out at something, like, do I do things for free for other people? Or, mm-hmm. you know, do I kind of like say yes to everything? So kind of going on to the book. So what was your motivation behind writing the book?
The opportunity presented itself. And again, in my own story, I've had people weave in and out telling me I should write a book. And I always kind of, thank you, but no, I'm not going to do that kind of thing. So this time around, when I had the opportunity, I did. I'm like, yes, I'll do it. And then as I started writing it, I will admit there were thoughts like, oh, why'd I say yes? But I'm very grateful that I did. But it's just was a timing thing more than anything else. And I think there was a fear around it, and I didn't want fear to stop me. So I said yes.
Yeah, that seems like really good, and just kind of giving yourself like a new challenge. So what was your favorite part of writing the book?
My favorite part, truly, it was probably being creative with some exercises and developing quizzes and the graphics. Coming up with those things were really fun, as well as just researching, you know, current sources, I guess, you know, to have statistics to back up what I was saying. So I think that those were the most enjoyable pieces to it.
Yeah, so I think that's, like, as somebody who, you know, debates all the time and we write cases and stuff like that, I definitely agree. I think that's a very interesting part of the process. So kind of piggybacking off of that, what was maybe the most challenging part of writing the book?
Writing it. I mean, honestly, because I have kind of a squirrel brain. I can go spiral, especially even reading the research, and then there's another link and another link and another link. So I really understand how, you know, we can be on the computer for hours and, you know, it's easy to be distracted. But I really enjoyed that piece, but it did kind of take me away from somewhat the writing of it. And then it's just really, I guess, writing, getting it all out and then going back and organizing it better and that kind of thing. So I think that piece wasn't as enjoyable for me. And because I didn't enjoy it as much, was more of a challenge for me.
Yeah. I think that's something that I was just talking to a girl yesterday who was writing her own book, and she said similar things. So I think that's generally like a kind of good consensus, is just like the part where you feel the most like trapped and stuff. So what was your favorite project that you've worked on, whether that be your book or your podcast or something else?
Well, I would say the podcast is a lot of fun because I get to meet a lot of people and hear their different perspectives. And I really love giving teens a voice as well, and college students. So by having the podcast, I get to interview teens and college students, not just adults. So I do really appreciate that. I would say the PhD was another thing I really enjoyed working on because I was exposed to different perspectives. I mean, that's what kind of college is about, or school is about, I think. And so I just loved that. So those would be my, and that and working with students, that is my passion.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. And I mean, like, this is a podcast geared toward teens, so I think you're in your comfort zone here. So
yes.
Yeah, so I mean, your whole brand is based off of working with teens, and I think that all the work that you do is really great. So what got you initially interested in working with teens as an age group specifically?
It's a very good question. And again, I want to emphasize that a lot of this is an evolution, because I think oftentimes there's kind of a societal and possibly even a parental expectation for us to have it all figured out, when in reality we don't. And so I do want to emphasize that. But I think for me, again, it was just something I fell into. I was working at a family and youth counseling agency in the Silicon Valley, and that opened doors to me being a counselor in some high schools and one middle school. And again, it was just listening to the teens' feedback of, you know, how I impacted their life. And I think that just reinforced, like, that, yeah, I'm on the right track. And then I'm also a mom and survived both my daughter's teen years as a single mom. So I understand really the challenges. And then also being a homeschooling mom, for part of that time, education is a real value of mine. And so as a single mom, I entered kind of into a private practice. I worked for a private practice specializing in educational therapy. And again, most of my clients were middle schoolers through college students. And I don't know, it just seemed to open up. By me following my passion and what I love, things just opened up to align with that. And then I will say lastly that I think with my own struggles and my own story later in adulthood, I really uncovered a lot of the limiting beliefs, some of them I didn't even know existed. And so uncovering that and realizing that those limiting points of view are what really kept me stuck in a lot of ways, I'm committed to helping teens, you know, kind of decondition, if you will, with some of those limiting beliefs, so that they don't have to hopefully go through some of the struggles that I had to.
Yeah, I think that's really amazing. And just kind of going back, maybe like reflecting on your own experiences and then kind of teaching that to a younger generation. Mm-hmm. So you were mentioning before how you think that a lot of pressure on teens is, you know, that they have to have everything figured out. And I feel like even at, you know, a point in my life where I'm still in high school, just like, oh, what college are you going to next year? You know, what are your plans? So what is some advice that you have for maybe teens who don't really know what they want to do when they grow up? And how would you like figure that out?
That's a great question. Be curious. Really be curious. I mean, look around, think about different things that you're seeing that you might be interested in. Maybe do some research on that. For example, I know this wasn't as a teenager, but when I was early in college, I think my first year, even though I had the passion of psychology and that was in my heart, you know, you're exposed to so many things. And I really have a passion for animals. So at one point I thought, oh, maybe I'll major in marine biology. But then when I did more research, I realized that most of the jobs, not all, but most of them, I'm most likely will be doing research in some kind of laboratory. And that just didn't fit for me. That's not what I would want to do. Now, if I was going to go out and swim with dolphins all day, whole different story. So it's kind of like, you know, be curious, do some research, see what is involved with some of those different professions. But I really think bottom line underneath it all is this: really tapping into what lights you up, what makes your heart sing. And if you follow that, that will give you clues to your purpose. Or if you look at things that you're really angry about, maybe there's a, you know, some social justice issue that you really, you know, really want to fight for, or anything that you're really fearful of. For example, my daughter was fearful, never believed, again, a limiting belief, that she was very good with science. So even though she wanted to be a veterinarian, she didn't pursue it because of that fear. And it wasn't until her last semester of college that she looked at that fear and then went to, you know, go on that path. So it can be an evolution, but I think those are, look at what makes you, what lights you up. Be curious, because things will open up for you. Try out new things. Do some research about what's involved. And I think also look at what makes you angry about the way the world is today. What would you like to change about it? And also maybe even looking at some of your fears might give you a clue, some clues as to what your purpose is. And don't be tied to expectations. That's the other thing.
Absolutely. I think that's really good advice, and advice that I definitely am going to be taking as I kind of continue on this journey. And I think that a lot of our listeners will be taking as well. So as you were kind of talking about that, you were mentioning how a lot of people have, you know, like limiting fears and limiting beliefs. So are there any ways that you could think of that you could kind of use to face those fears?
Wow, that's a really, really good question. I think, first of all, it's becoming aware of them and being truthful with yourself about them. That is easier said than done, because sometimes we think we're truthful, but there might be something underlying that is actually really more what's the reason for the way we were reacting, let's say. So just kind of be open to receiving what kind of comes to you, and being honest with yourself. That's super important. But also, I think with me, I just made the choice. I demanded of myself, I committed to myself that I'm not going to let fear stand in my way. I was tired of doing that. And so I made a conscious choice. So I think, one, it's just being aware of what your fears are and stuff. And then two, sometimes even looking at those, like if you're really anxious or worried about something, kind of spin it. So you may have heard this, but if you think, oh, but what if I fail at this? You know, it's like, but what if you succeed? What would that look like? And how much better you feel, get into your body and how you're feeling lighter and you have more space. And when you're in that space, you're going to be able to open up to more possibilities as well. Whereas, you know, kind of the fear and the dread can just keep us down. So, and sometimes it is me just saying, or looking in the mirror and saying, nope, I'm not going to talk to myself that way. And I'm not going to let fear stop me. And then I just do it.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And again, I think that's like something that's super useful for teens, especially in today's kind of climate with, you know, all sorts of outside pressures. So what's one of your favorite parts of working with teens?
Well, the actual working with them, I really like the one-to-one interaction. Mm-hmm. My favorite part is their creativity. Every teen I have worked with is absolutely brilliant and makes some really cool connections. So they open my mind. So I really like listening to their perspectives. And I really like seeing really the different way that they tackle a problem or, you know, use their creativity. So And then, of course, getting results with teens. That's my absolute favorite. Because then we both get to celebrate because, you know, it was kind of a team effort and that feels really good.
Yeah, I'm sure that does. And I think that that's like one thing that I was kind of thinking about while you were talking is like, you know, maybe like teens don't feel like all the adults in the world understand them. But I think that it's great to have somebody like you who you can kind of just like talk to and you're so willing to like learn from other people's experiences. And yeah, I think that's really cool.
Thank you.
So what might be one challenge of being a teen psychologist that most people wouldn't think of?
As an expert with teens, I would say that maybe people have thought about this, but what comes up for me is really the resistance with teens. Mm-hmm. I actually, even with the teens that have been at first unwilling or resistant to kind of being open to working with me, usually I can turn that around pretty quickly because trust and rapport gets developed pretty quickly, I think. But that is a challenge, I will say. Sometimes it can take a couple of sessions. But I think, to be honest, even more challenging is supporting the parents through some of it. Yeah. Because as a parent, as anyone, when we're stuck, I guess, in the problem, so to say, and I say that in quotes, okay? I'm not saying that teen is the problem, but whatever the issue is, it's really hard for us to see anything beyond that. And sometimes as parents, we have these expectations, which are pressures on the teen. Oftentimes that's how teens receive it, but we have these expectations and our own perspective and opinion on ways of doing things. And bottom line is most parents are loving and well-meaning for sure. But, sometimes, you know, we all just get stuck in old patterns. So I think it's helping parents to let go of some of those things and kind of shift to seeing it a different way. And then, but it's worth it once they have a better relationship with their teenager. It's worth all the effort. But I would say that's probably even more challenging than working with the teen's resistance, to be truthful.
Yeah. I completely get that. And I feel like parents might have like a different perspective on what the actual issue is than maybe right. The teens do. Kind of along those lines, a more current event is, you know, we're kind of all stuck together at this time, and it might be a difficult time for teens and parents to be constantly together. I know it's been hard, and you know, I just kind of want to go out with my friends, and it might be more difficult. But what are some ways that teens and parents could maintain a healthy relationship during this time?
Well, one is, I think, allow your teen to have some of their own time and to have their space and maybe, you know, work together or encourage your teen to think of some ways to do that where they're still going to be safe, but, you know, where they can, yeah, have their own time. So that would be one thing. And I guess, too, also thinking about just different ways of how you can have your own time, whether that's exercise or whether that's journaling in your room and not being interrupted by your mom, dad, or siblings, or, you know, or maybe it is even going out with some friends and then kind of going over, you know, a few of the what ifs. What if they're not wearing their mask, or what if they don't practice social distancing? I mean, just, you know, asking questions of your teen so that they feel, or even the parent can have more peace of mind letting their teens go out and hang out with friends, that knowing that they're going to still be safe or practice protocols, I guess. But that would be one option. And the other thing, too, it's not so much time away, but I again, want to emphasize it, and it's so simple, and we know it, but what I want to emphasize is actually doing it. And I think it's really important for at least one of the parents to have one-to-one time with the teen on a consistent basis and just arrange for that on a weekly, you know, like just a weekly check-in, and just really be present for your teenager to, you know, to vent and just to really listen, and always ask them whether they want suggestions or advice or they want you to just listen. I think as parents, we forget that and we just want to give them advice and solve a problem. And that may not be what your teen really wants or needs at the time. So I would also emphasize that as well.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And I feel like the last point that you were making, I feel like that happens so much time. Sometimes I just want my mom to just like listen and, you know, maybe the solution she offers isn't like the one that I think is going to be the best. So then it kind of starts an argument that way. So I think that's a good suggestion. I'll just be like, hey, can you just listen and not suggest? But yeah, I think those are some really good strategies because I think that it's a difficult time with us all just being at home and so close together all the time. And even with, you know, school, whether you're going back or you're not, I think, yeah, it's going to be really difficult. So kind of along those lines of going back to school now, a concern of a lot of parents right now might be that kids and teens especially are using too much screen time, whether that's FaceTiming with their friends, being on social media, or like playing video games online. So what would be your opinion or boundaries about this type of screen time considering the circumstances?
Well, I think the situations are, you know, it's different based on the age, and I think it's different just given the circumstances. So I'm going to presume that a lot of parents, you know, all of us were kind of jolted abruptly into this, like, school shutdown, shelter, you know, sheltering in place, all of that, and working from home for parents. So I think probably a lot of parents allowed more screen time because they still had to get their work done. And, you know, it's just like we were all in this crisis mode and trying to figure it out. And so I think now that school's here and there's a little more predictability, at least for this semester, of, you know, whether it's going to be a hybrid or you're physically going back or whatever, I think it's really important to explain kind of what the expectations are. And, you know, ease up on the video gaming, because maybe, I'm just going to throw out a number here, but let's say your teen was on video games 3 to 4 hours a day because you had to work or whatever. Well, now school started, that's not going to work too well. So maybe it's an hour. And then, you know, what are your expectations? You know, grades are always a great indicator, you know, but getting assignments in and that kind of thing in on time. And if that's what you expect and your teen's doing it and then they want, you know, and video games is something they really enjoy, then, you know, in a way they can have more video gaming time given that some of these expectations were met, I guess. And I think it just varies because, like, social media, I would not say take it away. I think that tends to be, or really limit it, because it's just different times. I mean, that's just, I just don't think that would serve teenagers. But I think, like, for a middle schooler, the social media versus, let's say, a teen or college student with social media, it is a little bit different, because they're just at a different stage. So I think there's a lot more comparison, for example, that goes on. Whereas I think, you know, teenagers and kind of beyond, they can kind of, we all compare, but there's a little more awareness of not to compare, I guess, or to know that, you know, something's been photoshopped or what's realistic and what isn't. So in that case, for example, I might want to limit the social media for middle schooler a little more than I would limit it for like a teenager, you know, but yeah, so.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I think that it's definitely a difficult time because like you kind of still want to stay connected with your friends, but you like don't want to just be like screen overload. So kind of on the social media thing, I know that this was a big issue at my school. I assume that it is at a lot of other middle schools in the past. But so what would you say is like a good age for, I mean, you could give like an age range to for kids to start getting on social media.
I might be kind of old fashioned in that. For some reason, 12 comes to mind, but you know, it just depends. I think there just needs to be boundaries around it, I guess, and conversation around it, you know, as far as with social media and that kind of thing. And limitations. And it depends on, I really do think it depends on, I mean, parents know their kids better than anyone, just where they're their child is at to kind of determine the social media thing.
Yeah. So when you say parents could determine like where their child's at, that's just kind of like as you were saying before, like, you know, with like maybe comparison to other kids or like the maturity level, things of that nature. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's good advice for like, just kind of like maybe criteria for parents to look at. Cause I mean, I wasn't allowed to have social media till I started high school, but I know some kids are getting it in like third or fourth grade. So there's definitely a lot of, variation in that. But I think I agree. I think that 12 is probably a good age to start with like some limited fashion. Yeah, so kind of on the piggyback of this whole back to school discussion. So I think that we all know that back to school is going to be difficult this year and there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. So what would be your recommendation to teens who are really nervous about going to school online this semester?
Well, I think look at what the concerns are with the online. That would be one thing, even maybe writing them out. But really, again, thinking about what you can control, that is really helpful. I think that's part of the reason why anxiety is so high right now, is because there is so much uncertainty. There isn't a lot of predictability. We don't know when the next change is going to happen, right? So it's almost like they're ready with the fight, flight, or flee response. You know, we're already kind of heightened. So I think if you can kind of shift a little bit of perspective and think about the things that you can control, the things that you can plan for. Again, you know, like the example, if you really want to be mindful of the safety protocols and you have some classmates that aren't following that, thinking about, you know, ideas of what you can do in that situation, or talking to a parent or another friend who might have some ideas with that, or what are they going to do? Even if they have those concerns, I think is helpful as well. And then just be kind of go into it with curiosity. And again, just as much as things you can worry about, you know, there could be some successes or some real positive things too, and kind of shifting your mind to thinking about those things. And I think also, I just want to add this because this came up for me with my daughter recently, and that is, oftentimes when we come to a conclusion or we have a belief, that's kind of the lens through which we see something, right?
Yeah.
And then we see all the evidence, right? That's how we perceive it, to make that belief true, like it's a fact. So sometimes when we're anxious, we have all these kind of fears and nervousness around, and all these, you know, kind of quote negative what ifs. And also just be aware as you move throughout your day of paying attention to maybe some of those things didn't actually, maybe it was the reverse. Like, for example, with my daughter, she was worried about, she had been away so long, so she was worried in her particular situation if people would still want to do like her program and still want to be involved and carry on that relationship with her. And so that was her worry. That was a real concern for her. And it turns out that, you know, she recently got, you know, an email and everyone still involved wants to do the program. They're reaching out to her in other ways. So obviously she still matters and she had an impact on them. All those things are evidence for, you know, her really having an impact or doing a good job or whatever it is for the belief. And it is not evidence for, what if they hate me? I'm worried that they're going to hate me, or they're not going to like me, or they're not going to want to do the program anymore. It wasn't any of that. So kind of keep a journal or just mentally note things that are showing up in your world that's contrary to, you know, what you are worried about.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, and just kind of like focusing more on what are the positive aspects of moving online, whether that be more time to do homework or, I don't know, yeah, like other positive things. So as we kind of transition into maybe you're going to school part-time, maybe you're going to school completely online, do you think that if a student maybe has like a slight slip in their grades just because of the change in atmosphere, do you think that's something that parents should be concerned about or something that shouldn't be concerning at all?
No, I don't necessarily think it needs to be concerned right away, because whenever most of us go through any kind of transition, sometimes we're there are slips in other areas, so to speak, right? So
yeah.
So no, I wouldn't be concerned about that, but I would want to kind of, you know, be interested in into, you know, why the grade slipped, you know, if it's lack of motivation, if it's you know, I've worked with students that honestly, as tech savvy as they are, sometimes they don't know, you know, how to really submit an assignment online, you know, and they think they had it down and they followed the instructions, but it didn't get to the teacher. So sometimes slips in grades can be that simple, that it's, you know, there's some other issue that can be pretty much solved right away, and it has nothing to do with the emotional side of things. But absolutely, grades are going to slip when, you know, there's other things going on in anybody's life, I think, in a student's life. So just be mindful of that. And if it continues to slip, then I think we need to look at kind of more the underlying reasons of why that might be.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, good advice. And I think that, you know, a lot of kids are going to maybe see some, like, you know, grade pitfalls this fall, and just to not get discouraged mm-hmm. by that, and to just kind of like find the problem and work on solving it rather than just being so disappointed about it. So I've just got one final question for you here. So when should teens, like, and maybe they could recognize it or their parents could recognize it, when should they seek the help of a psychologist or therapist or any sort of outside help with things of this nature?
I think with a psychologist or therapist, I think definitely if you're waking up more depressed than usual is definitely, or if you're even anxious a lot of the time, seeking therapy might really help. Or if you just feel like you and your parents just aren't getting along at all, I think I also feel like every teen can use an ally that's not their parent, because I just feel like that's their unique support system, and it's a little more objective than the parents and can serve as a mediator between the teen and the parent. So I do think that is very helpful. But I also think even with academics, if your grades are starting to slip, that is also a good time. Now, I don't think you necessarily need a therapist for that, because there are education specialists, you know, or educational therapists that can help, tutors, that kind of thing. But determining what you need, I think going to someone, you know, a professional in the field of education is helpful. Not teachers, I mean, you know, like an educational therapist or consultant. Yeah, and I think so if grades are a problem, or it's grades are not to where you want them over a few subjects, not just one, then you're going to want to kind of seek out that help or ask your parents that you'd like to receive some extra support.
Yeah, definitely. And for anybody listening out there, Dr. Scherer has a great educational therapy service. She works with teens all the time, as you've seen throughout this podcast. So yeah, I think that's a good threshold for, you know, finding help and getting help. And yeah, I think that might wrap up our discussion today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and helping with all these teen issues.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Oh, no problem. A special thanks to Dr. Scherer for joining us on today's episode. You can check her out on Instagram at Dr. Kimberly PhD, Twitter at Dr. Kimberly S, or her website www.afi4me.com. If you are a teen or parent looking for teen help, Dr. Scherer is a great resource. You can also check out her book, Unstoppable Teens. You can check out this podcast on Instagram at @fascinating_jobs_pod, Twitter at @fascinatingjobs, or our website, www.fascinatingjobs.xyz. Be sure to rate or review this podcast wherever you listen to let us know you're enjoying it. And if you or someone you know has a fascinating job, email us at fascinatingjobspod@gmail.com for a chance to be a guest on the show. Thank you so much for listening and enjoying this podcast, and I'll see you in the next episode.